After I pull my eyes from her, I realize that I'm not the only one dumbstruck. Many of the young men around me sneak glances at her. She doesn't seem to notice, which, of course, makes her all the more intriguing. And here you are, Elias, staring at her again, you twit. This time, my attention hasn't gone unobserved. Izzy is watching me. The girl might have only one eye, but I'm fairly certain she sees more than most. Get out of here, Elias, I tell myself, before she figures out why you look so damn familiar. Izzy leans over and whispers something into Lia's ear. I'm about to walk away when Lia looks up at me. Her eyes are a dark jolt. I should look away. I should leave. She'll figure out who I am if she stares long enough. But I can't bring myself to move. For a heavy, heated moment, we are immobile, content to watch each other. Skies, she's beautiful. I smile at her, and the blush that rises on her face makes me feel oddly triumphant. I want to ask her to dance. I want to touch her skin and talk to her, and pretend that I'm just a normal tribal boy, and she's just a normal scholar girl. Stupid idea, my mind warns. She'll recognize you. So what? What would she do? Turn me in? She can't tell the commandant she saw me here without incriminating herself too. But while I'm still considering, a muscular, red-haired boy comes up behind her. He touches her shoulder with a possessiveness in his eyes that I don't like. Lia, in return, stares at him as if no one else exists. Maybe she knew him before she became a slave. Maybe he's the reason she snuck out. I scowl and look away. He's not bad-looking, I suppose, but he seems too grim to be any fun. Also, he's shorter than me, considerably shorter, half a foot at least. Lia leaves with the redhead. Izzy gets up after a moment and follows.
Looks like she's taken, lad.
A tribal girl wearing a bright green dress, covered in tiny circular mirrors, sashays up to me, her dark hair done up in hundreds of braids. She speaks Sudhese, the tribal tongue I grew up with. Against her dusky skin, her smile is a blinding flash of white, and I find myself returning it.
I guess I'll have to do, she says.
Without waiting for a reply, she pulls me to the dance floor, a remarkably bold thing for a tribal girl to do. I look at her closely and realize that she's not a girl, but a grown woman, perhaps a few years older than me. I eye her warily. Most tribeswomen have a few children by their mid-twenties. Don't you have a husband who'll take off my head if he sees me dancing with you? I respond in Sudhese.
I don't. Why, are you interested in the position?
She runs a warm, slow finger down the skin of my chest and stomach, all the way to my belt. For the first time in a decade or so, I blush. Her wrist, I notice, is free of the tribal braid tattoo that would mark her as married.
What's your name and tribe, lad?
She asks. She's a good dancer, and when I match her step for step, I can tell she's pleased.
Ilias.
I haven't spoken my tribal name in years. Grandfather martialized it within about 5 minutes of meeting me. Ilias Ansaif. As soon as I say it, I wonder if it's a mistake. The story of Mamie Reela's adopted son being taken to Blackcliff isn't well known. The Empire ordered Tribe Saif to keep it quiet. Still, tribesmen love to talk. But if the woman recognizes the name, she doesn't acknowledge it.
I'm Afia Ara Nur,
she says. Shadows and light. I translate her first name and her tribal name. Fascinating combination.
Mostly shadows, to be honest.
She leans toward me, and the smolder in her brown eyes makes my heart beat a little faster.
But keep that between us.
I tilt my head as I look at her. I don't think I've ever met a tribal woman with such sultry self-possession. Not even a Kahani. Afia smiles a secret smile and asks me a few polite questions about tribe Scythe. How many weddings have we had in the past month? How many births? Will we journey to Nur for the fall gathering? Though the questions are suitable for a tribal woman, I'm not fooled. Her simple words don't match the sharp intelligence of her eyes. Where is her family? Who is she really? As if sensing my suspicion, Afia tells me of her brothers, rug traders based in Nur, here to sell their wares before bad weather closes off the mountain passes. As she speaks, I look around surreptitiously for these brothers of hers. Tribal men are notoriously protective of their unwed women, and I'm not looking for a fight. But though there are plenty of tribesmen in the crowd, none of them so much as look at Afia. We stay together for three dances. When the last is over, Afia curtsies and offers me a wooden coin with the sun on one side and clouds on the other.
A gift, she says, for honoring me with such fine dances, Ilias and Scythe.
The honor is mine. I'm surprised. Tribal tokens mark a favor owed. They're not offered lightly and are rarely given out by women. As if she knows what I'm thinking, Afia stands on her tiptoes. She's so tiny I have to stoop to hear her.
If the heir of Jens Veturia should ever need a favor, Ilias, Tribe Nur will be honored to be of service.
Immediately my body tenses, but she puts two fingers to her lips, the most binding of tribal vows.
Your secret is safe with Afiar Aranur.
I raise an eyebrow. Whether she recognized the name Ilias or has seen me around Sarah masked, I don't know. Whoever Afia Aranur is, she's no simple tribal woman. I nod in acknowledgement, and her white teeth flash.
Ilias.
She drops down, no longer whispering.
Your lady is free now. See?
I look over my shoulder. Lyra has returned to the dance stage and is watching the redhead walk away from her.
You must claim her for a dance,
Afia says.
Go on.
She gives me a small shove and disappears, the bells on her ankle tinkling. I stare after her for a moment, looking at the coin thoughtfully before pocketing it. Then I turn and make my way to Lyra.
Chapter 29. Lyra. May I? My mind is still on Keenan, and I am startled to find the tribal boy standing beside me. For a moment, I can only stare dumbly up at him. Would you like to dance? He clarifies, offering a hand. The low hood shadows his eyes, but his lips curve into a smile. Now that I've given my report, Izzy and I should get back to Blackcliff. Dawn is still a few hours away, but I shouldn't risk getting caught. Ah, the boy smiles. The redhead. Your husband? What? No. Fiancé. No, he's not. Lover? The boy lifts an eyebrow suggestively. My face grows hot. He's my friend. Then why worry? The boy flashes a grin, tinged with wickedness, and I find myself smiling in return. I glance over my shoulder at Izzy, talking to an earnest-looking scholar. She laughs at something he says, her hands, for once, not straying to her eye patch. When she catches me watching, she looks between the tribal boy and me and waggles her eyebrows. My face goes hot again. One dance can't hurt. We can leave after. The fiddlers are playing a lilting ballad, and at my nod, the boy takes my hands as confidently as if we'd been friends for years. Despite his height and the width of his shoulders, he leads with a grace that is effortless and sensual all at once. When I peek at him, I find him staring down at me, a faint smile on his lips. My breath hitches, and I cast about for something to say. You don't sound like a tribesman. There, that's neutral enough. You've hardly got an accent. Though his eyes are scholar dark, his face is all edges and hard lines. You don't really look like one either.
I can say something in Sedhese, if you like.
He drops his lips to my ear, and the spice of his breath sends a pleasant shiver through me.
Manaya espula dila de kanala.
I sigh. No wonder tribesmen can sell anything. His voice is warm and deep like summer honey dripping off the comb. What? My voice is hoarse, and I clear my throat. What does it mean? He gives me that smile again.
I'd really have to show you.
Up comes the blush. You're very bold. I narrow my eyes. Where have I seen him before? Do you live around here? You seem familiar.
And you're calling me bold.
I look away, realizing how my comment must sound. He chuckles in response, low and hot, and my breath catches again. I feel suddenly sorry for the girls in his tribe.
I'm not from Sarah, he says. So, who's the redhead?
Who's the brunette? I challenge back.
Ah, you were spying on me. That's very flattering.
I wasn't. I was... So were you.
It's all right, he says reassuringly. I don't mind if you spy on me. The brunette is Afya of Tribe Nur. A new friend.
Just a friend. Looked to me like a bit more than that.
Maybe, he shrugs. You never answered my question. About Red?
Red is a friend. I mimic the boy's pensive tone. A new friend. The boy tosses his head back and laughs, a laugh that falls gentle and wild, like desert rain.
You live in the quarter? He asks.
I hesitate. I can't tell him I'm a slave. Slaves aren't allowed at the Moon Festival. Even a stranger to Sarah will know that. Yes, I say. I've lived in the quarter for years, with my grandparents, and my brother. Our house isn't far from here. I don't know why I say it. Perhaps I think that by speaking the words, they will prove true, and I will turn to see Darin flirting with girls, Nan hawking her jams, and Pop dealing, ever gently, with overly worried patience. The boy spins me around, and then pulls me back into the circle of his arms, closer than before. His smell, spicy and heady and bizarrely familiar, makes me want to lean closer, to inhale. The hard planes of his muscles press into me, and when his hips brush mine, I nearly fumble my steps.
And how do you fill your days?
Pop's a healer. My voice falters at the lie, but since I can't very well tell him the truth, I rush on. My brother's his apprentice. Nan and I make jam, mostly for the tribes.
You strike me as a jam maker.
Really? Why? He grins down at me. Up close, his eyes look almost black, especially shadowed, as they are by long eyelashes. Right now, they shine with barely restrained mirth.
Because you're so sweet, he says in a mock saccharine voice.
The mischief in his eyes makes me forget, for a too brief second, that I am a slave, and that my brother is in prison, and that everyone else I love is dead. Laughter explodes out of me like a song, and my eyes blur and tear.
A snort escapes, which sets my dance partner to laughing, which makes me laugh harder.
Only Darin ever made me laugh like this. The release is foreign and familiar, like crying, but without the pain. What's your name? I ask, as I wipe my face. But instead of answering, he goes still, his head cocked, as if he's listening for something. When I speak, he puts a finger to my lips. A moment later, his face hardens.
We have to go, he says.
If he didn't look so dead serious, I think he was trying to get me to come with him to his camp.
A raid. A martial raid.
Around us, dancers spin on obliviously. None of them has heard the boy. Drums thump, children scamper and giggle. All seems well. Then he shouts it, loud enough that everyone can hear.
Raid! Run!
His deep voice echoes across the dance stages, as commanding as a soldier's. The fiddlers stop mid-note, the drums cease.
Marshal, raid! Get out! Go!
A burst of light shatters the silence. One of the sky lamps has exploded, and another. Arrows zing through the air. The marshals are shooting out the lights, hoping to leave the festival-goers in darkness so they can herd us easily.
Liar!
Izzy is beside me, eye wide with panic.
What's happening?
Some years the marshals let us have the festival. Other years, they don't.
We have to get out of here.
I grab Izzy's hand, wishing I'd never brought her, wishing I'd thought more of her safety.
Follow me.
The boy doesn't wait for an answer, just pulls me to a nearby street, one that isn't yet flooded with people. He keeps to the walls, and I follow behind, holding tightly to Izzy and hoping it's not too late for us to escape. When we reach the middle of the street, the tribesman pulls us into a narrow, trash-strewn alley. Screams rend the air and steel flashes. Seconds later, festival-goers stream past, many falling out of sight, cut down as they run, like stalks of wheat beneath a sickle.
We have to get out of the quarter before they lock it down, the tribesman says. Anyone caught in the streets will be thrown into ghost wagons. You'll have to move fast. Can you do that?
We can't go with you. I pull my hand from the boys. He'll head for his caravan, but Izzy and I will find no safety there. Once his people see we're slaves, they'll turn us over to the marshals, who will turn us over to the commandant, and then...
We don't live in the quarter. I'm sorry, I lied.
I back away, pulling Izzy with me, knowing that the quicker we go our separate ways, the better it will be for all concerned. The tribesman shoves back his hood to reveal a head of close-cropped black hair.
I know that, he says.
And though his voice is the same, there's something subtly different about him. A menace. A power in his body that wasn't there before. Without thinking, I take another step back.
You have to go to Blackcliff, he says.
For a moment, his words don't register. When they do, my knees go weak. He's a spy. Did he see my slave's cuts? Did he overhear me talking to Mazin? Will he turn Izzy and me in? Then Izzy gasps. Aspirant Veturius. When Izzy says his name, it's like lamplight flooding a murky chamber. His features, his height, his easy grace. Everything makes perfect sense, and yet no sense at all. What is an aspirant doing at a moon festival? Why was he trying to pass as a tribesman? Where's his damned mask?
Your eyes.
They were dark, I think wildly. I'm sure they were dark.
Willadonna,
he says, broadens the pupils.
Look, we should really...
You're spying on me for the commandant, I burst out. It's the only explanation. Keris Veturia ordered her son to follow me, to see what I know. But if that's the case, he probably overheard me talking to Mazin and Keenan. He has more than enough information to turn me in for treason. Why dance with me? Why laugh and joke with me? Why warn the festival-goers about the raid?
I wouldn't spy for her if it meant my life.
Then why are you here? There's no possible reason.
There is, but it's not one I can explain right now.
Veturius looks to the streets, then adds,
We can argue about it if you like, or we can get the hell out of here.
He's a mask, and I should look away from him. I should show my subservience, but I can't stop staring. It's a jolt, his face. A few minutes ago, I thought he was beautiful. I thought his words in Sadhis were hypnotic. I danced with a mask. A bleeding, burning mask. Veturius
peers out of the alleyway and shakes his head. The Legionnaires will have sealed off the quarter by the time we get to one of the gates. We'll have to take the tunnels and hope they haven't sealed those off.
He moves confidently to a grate in the alleyway, as if he knows exactly where we are in the quarter. When I don't follow, he makes a sound of irritation.
Look, I'm not in league with her, he says. In fact, if she finds out I came here, she'll probably flay me. Slowly. But that's nothing compared to what she'll do to you if you're caught in this raid or if she discovers you missing from Blackcliff at dawn. If you want to live, you'll have to trust me. Now move.
Izzy does as he says, and reluctantly I follow, my whole body rebelling at the thought of putting my life in the hands of a mask. Almost as soon as we drop down into the tunnel, Veturius pulls fatigues and boots from the bag across his chest and begins tearing off his tribal clothes. My face burns and I turn away, but not before seeing the chilling map of silvery scars across his back. Seconds later, he walks past us, masked once more and gesturing for us to follow. Izzy and I run to keep up with his long strides. He moves, stealthily, as a cat, silent but for a word of encouragement here and there. We make our way north and east through the catacombs, stopping only to avoid passing martial patrols. Veturius never falters. When we reach a pile of skulls blocking the passage ahead, he moves a few aside and helps us through the opening. When the tunnel we're in narrows to a locked grate, he plucks two pins from my hair and picks the lock in seconds. Izzy and I exchange a glance at that. His sheer competence is unnerving. I've no idea how much time has passed. At least 2 hours. It must be nearly dawn. We won't make it back on time. The Commandant will catch us. Skies, I shouldn't have brought Izzy. I shouldn't have put her at risk. My wound chafes against my dress until it's bleeding. It is only a few days old and the infection has lingered. The pain combined with my fear makes me light-headed. Veturius slows when he sees my face.
We're almost there, he says. Do you need me to carry you?
I shake my head vehemently. I don't want to be close to him again. I don't want to breathe in his smell or feel the warmth of his skin. Eventually, we stop. Low voices mutter from around the corner ahead of us, and a flickering torch deepens the shadows the light can't reach. All the underground entrances to Blackcliff are guarded, Veturius whispers. This one has 4 guards. If they see you, they'll sound an alarm, and these tunnels will be swarming with soldiers. He looks between Izzy and me to make sure we understand before going on. I'm going to draw them off. When I say docks, you'll have a minute to get around this corner, up the ladder and out the grate. When I say Madame Modes, it means you're nearly out of time. Shut the grate behind you. You'll be in Blackcliff's main cellar. Wait for me there. Veturius disappears into the gloom of a tunnel just behind us. A few minutes later, we hear what sounds like drunken singing. I peer around the corner to see the guards elbowing each other and grinning. 2 leave to investigate. Veturius's voice is convincingly slurred, and there's a loud crash followed by a curse and a burst of laughter. One of the soldiers who's gone to investigate calls to the other 2. They disappear. I lean forward, preparing to run. Come on, come on. Finally, Veturius's voice drifts down the tunnels.
Down by the dockish.
Izzy and I bolt for the ladder, and in seconds we've reached the grate. I'm congratulating myself on our speed when Izzy, perched above me, lets out a strangled cry. I can't get it open! I climb past her, grab the grate and shove it upward. It doesn't budge. The guards get closer. I hear another loud crash, and then Veturius saying,
The best girls are mammos. They really know how to...
Liar! Izzy looks frantically toward the fast-approaching torchlight. 10 burning hells. With a muffled grunt, I throw my whole body toward the grate, wincing at the pain lancing through my torso. The grate creaks open unwillingly,
and I practically shove Izzy through before leaping up myself, shutting it just as the soldiers emerge into the tunnel below. Izzy takes cover behind a barrel, and I join her. A few seconds later, Vaturis climbs out of the grate, giggling drunkenly. Izzy and I exchange another glance, and, as preposterous as it is, I find I'm suppressing my laughter.
"Thanks, boys,"
Vaturis calls down into the tunnel. He slams the grate shut, spots us, and holds a finger to his lips. The soldiers can still hear us through the slats in the grate.
"Aspirant Vaturis," Izzy whispers. "What will happen to you if the Commandant finds out you've helped us?"
"She won't find out," Vaturis says, "unless you plan on telling her, which I don't suggest. Come on, I'll take you back to your quarters." We slip up the cellar stairs and out to Blackcliff's funerally quiet grounds. I shiver, although the night's not cold. It's still dark, but the eastern sky pales, and Vaturis speeds his gait. As we hurry across the grass, I stumble, and he is beside me, steadying me, his warmth seeping into my skin. "All right," he asks. My feet ache, my head pounds, and the Commandant's mark burns like fire. But more powerful is the tingling enveloping my entire body at the mask's closeness. "Danger!" my skin seems to scream. "He's dangerous!" "Fine," I jerk away from him. "I'm fine." As we walk, I sneak glances at him, with his mask on and the walls of Blackcliff rising around him. Vaturis is every inch the martial soldier. Yet I can't reconcile the image before me with the handsome tribesman I dance with. All that time, he knew who I was. He knew I was lying about my family. And though it's ridiculous to care what a mask thinks, I feel suddenly ashamed of those lies. We reach the servants' corridor, and Izzy breaks away from us. "Thank you," she says to Vaturis. Guilt washes over me. She'll never forgive me after what she's been through. "Izzy," I touch her arm. "I'm sorry. If I'd known about the raid, I'd never..." "Are you joking?" Izzy says. Her eye darts to Vaturis, standing behind me. And she smiles, a blaze of white that startles me with its beauty. "I wouldn't have traded this for anything. Good night, Lyra." I stare at her, open-mouthed, as she disappears down the hallway and into her room. Vaturis clears his throat. He's watching me with a strange, almost apologetic expression in his eyes.
I have something for you."
He pulls a bottle from his pocket.
"Sorry I didn't get it to you earlier. I was indisposed."
I take the bottle, and when our fingers touch, I pull away quickly. It's the blood root serum. I'm surprised he remembered.
"I'll just..."
"Thank you," I say at the same time. We both fall silent. Vaturis rubs a hand through his hair, but a second later, his entire body goes still. A deer that's heard the hunter. "What?" I gasp when his arms come around me, sudden and hard. He pushes me to the wall, heat flaring from his hands and tingling across my skin, sending my heart into a feverish beat. My own reaction to him, confusion tumbled with head-spinning want, shocks me into silence. "What is wrong with you, Lyra?" Then his hands tighten on my back as if in warning, and he dips his head low to my ear, his breath a bare whisper. "Do what I tell you, when I tell you, or you're dead." I knew it. How could I have trusted him? Stupid, so stupid. "Push me away," he says. "Fight me." I shove at him, not needing his encouragement.
"Get away from..."
"Don't be like that." His voice is louder now, sleek and menacing, and devoid of anything resembling decency. "You didn't mind before."
"Leave her, soldier,"
a bored, wintry voice says.
My blood goes cold, and I twist away from Vaturis. There, detaching from the kitchen door like a wraith,
stands the Commandant. How long has she been watching us? Why is she even awake? The Commandant steps into the corridor and surveys me dispassionately, ignoring Veturius. So, that's where you'd got to. Her pale hair is loose around her shoulders, her robe pulled tight. I just came down, rang the bell for water 5 minutes ago. I suppose it was only a matter of time. You are a pretty thing. She doesn't reach for her crop or threaten to kill me. She doesn't even seem angry, just irritated. Soldier, she says, back to the barracks with you. You've had her for long enough. Commandant, sir. Veturius breaks away from me with seeming reluctance. I try to squirm away from him, but he keeps a proprietary arm slung around my hips. You sent her to her quarters for the night. I assumed you were done with her. Veturius, the Commandant, I realize, hadn't recognized him in the dark. She hadn't cared enough to give him a second look. Her eyes shift to her son in disbelief. You, and a slave. I was bored, he shrugs. I've been stuck in the infirmary for days. My face goes hot. I understand now why he put his hands on me, why he told me to fight him. He is trying to protect me from the Commandant. He must have sensed her presence. She will have no way of proving I haven't spent the last few hours with Veturius, and since students rape slaves all the time, neither he nor I will be punished. But it's still humiliating. You expect me to believe you? The Commandant cocks her head. She senses the lie. She smells it. You've never touched a slave in your life. With all due respect, sir, that's because the first thing you do when you get a new slave is take her eye out. Veturius tangles his fingers in my hair, and I yelp. Or carve up her face. But this one... He yanks my head toward his, a warning in his eyes when he glances down at me. Is still intact. Mostly. Please. I drop my voice. If this is going to work, I need to play along, disgusting as it is. Tell him to leave me alone. Get out, Veturius. The Commandant's eyes glitter. Next time, find a kitchen drudge to entertain you. The girl is mine. Veturius gives his mother a short salute before releasing me and sauntering through the gate without so much as a backward glance. The Commandant looks me over, as if for signs of what she thinks just happened. She jerks my chin up. I pinch myself on the leg hard enough to draw blood, and my eyes fill with tears. Would it have been better if I'd cut your face? Like cooks, she murmurs. Beauty's a curse when one lives among men. You might have thanked me for it. She runs a fingernail across my cheek, and I shudder. Well, she lets me go and walks back to the kitchen door with a smile, a twist of her mouth that is all bitterness and no mirth. The spirals of her strange tattoo catch the moonlight. There's time yet for that.
Chapter 30 Elias. For 3 days after the moon festival, Helene avoids me. She ignores knocks on her door, leaves the mess hall when I appear, and begs off when I approach her head on. When we're paired together in training, she attacks me as if I'm Marcus. When I speak to her, she goes suddenly deaf. I let it go at first, but by the third day, I'm sick of it. On my way to combat training, I'm concocting a plan to confront her. Something involving a chair and rope, and maybe a gag, so she has no choice but to listen to me. When Kane appears beside me, as suddenly as a ghost. My sim is half-drawn before I realize who it is. Skies, Kane. Don't do that. Greetings, Aspirant Vittorius. Wonderful weather. The augur looks up at the hot blue sky admiringly.
Yeah, if you're not training with double sims under the baking sun, I mutter. It's not even noon, and I'm so covered in sweat that I've given up and taken off my shirt. If Helene was speaking to me, she'd frown and say it's not regulation. I'm too hot to care.
You are healed from the second trial? Cain asks.
No thanks to you. The words are out before I can stop them, but I don't feel particularly regretful. Multiple attempts on my life have taken a toll on my manners.
The trials are not meant to be easy, Elias. That is why they are called the trials.
I hadn't noticed. I speed up, hoping Cain will piss off. He doesn't.
I bring you a message, he says. The next trial will take place in 7 days.
At least we get some warning this time. What's it going to be? I ask. Public flogging? A knight locked in a trunk with 100 vipers?
Combat against a formidable foe, Cain says. Nothing you can't handle.
What foe? What's the catch? No way the augur will tell me what I'm up against without leaving something essential out. It's going to be a sea of wraiths we're fighting, or djinn, or some other beastie they've woken from the darkness.
We haven't woken anything from the darkness that wasn't already awake, Cain says.
I bite back a response. If he picks my mind again, I swear I'll shove this blade through him, augur or not.
It wouldn't do any good, Elias.
He smiles, almost sadly, then nods to the field, where Hel is training.
I ask that you pass the message along to Aspirant Aquila.
As Aquila isn't speaking with me, that might be a bit difficult.
I'm sure you'll find a way.
He drifts off, leaving me more ill-tempered than before. When Hel and I argue, we usually patch things up in a few hours, a day at most. 3 days is a record for us. Worse, I've never seen her lose her temper the way she did 3 nights ago. Even in battle, she is always cool, controlled. But she's been different the past few weeks. I've known it, though like a fool I've tried not to see it. But I can't ignore her behavior anymore. It has to do with that spark between us, that attraction. Either we crush it, or we do something about it. And I'm thinking that while the latter might be more enjoyable, it will create complications neither of us needs. When did Helene change? She has always been in control of every emotion, every desire. She's never shown interest in any of her comrades, and other than Leander, none of us is stupid enough to try to start anything with her. So what happened between us that changed things? I think back to the first time I noticed her acting strange, the morning she found me in the catacombs. I'd tried to distract her by leering. I'd done it without thinking, hoping to keep her from finding my pack. I figured she'd just think it was me being male. Is that what did it? That one look? Has she been acting so strangely because she thinks I want her, and so she feels like she has to want me back? If that's the case, then I need to clear things up with her straight away. I'll tell her that it was a fluke, that I didn't mean anything by it. Will she accept my apology? Only if you grovel enough. Fine. It will be worth it. If I want my freedom, I have to win the next trial. In the first two, Hel and I depended on each other for survival. The third will probably be the same. I need her on my side. I find Hel on the combat field sparring with Tristus, while a combat centurion looks on. The boys and I tease Tristus for constantly mooning over his fiancée, but he's one of the finest swordsmen at Blackcliff, clever and cat-swift. He waits for Helene to slip up, taking note of the aggression in her strokes. But her defense is as impenetrable as the walls of Koff. Minutes after I arrive at the field, she's thrown off Tristus's attack and jabbed his heart.
"Greetings, O holy aspirant!"
Tristus calls out when he sees me. At Helene's stiffening shoulders, he glances between us and makes a quick departure. Along with Faris and Dex, Tristus has tried repeatedly to figure out what went wrong between Helene and me on the night of the party, which neither of us attended. But Hel's been as silent as I have, and they've given up, instead grunting to one another pointedly when she and I beat each other down on the battlefield.
"Aquila!"
I call to her as she sheaths her Sims.
"I need to talk to you."
Silence. "Fine, then."
"Cain said to tell you the next trial is in 7 days.
I head to the armory, unsurprised when I hear her footsteps trailing.
"Well, what is it?"
She grabs my shoulder and pulls me around.
"What's the trial?"
Her face is flushed, and her eyes flash. Skies, she's pretty when she's angry. The thought surprises me, accompanied as it is by a pulse of fierce desire. "It's Helene, Elias. Helene."
"Combat," I say. "We'll be up against a formidable foe."
"Right,"
she says.
"Good."
But she doesn't move, only glares at me, unaware that the tendrils of hair that have escaped her braid make the glare much less intimidating than she'd like.
"Hel, look, I know you're mad, but..."
"Oh, go put on a shirt."
She stalks away, muttering about twits who flaunt regulation. I stifle an angry retort. Why is she so damn stubborn? As I enter the armory, I run straight into Marcus, who shoves me into the doorframe. For once, Zack's not with him.
"Your whore's still not talking to you,"
he says.
"Not spending time with you either, is she?
Avoiding you. Avoiding the other boys. Alone." He looks speculatively at Helene's retreating back, and I go for my Sim. But Marcus is already holding a dagger to my stomach.
"She belongs to me, you know. I dreamt it."
His calmness chills me more than any boasting could.
"One of these days, I'll find her, and you won't be around," he says. "And I'll make her mine."
"You stay away from her. Anything happens to her, I'll slit you open from your neck to your sorry."
"It's always threats with you,"
Marcus says.
"You never actually do anything. Not surprising for a traitor whose mask hasn't even melded yet."
He leans forward.
"The mask knows you're weak, Elias. It knows you don't belong. That's why it's still not a part of you. That's why I should kill you."
His dagger cuts into my stomach, releasing a trickle of blood. One thrust, one pull upward, and he could gut me like a fish. I shake with anger. I'm at his mercy, and I hate him for it.
But the centurions are watching.
Marcus's gaze flicks to our left, where the combat centurion is fast approaching.
"And I'd rather kill you slow."
He strolls away lazily, saluting the combat centurion as he passes. Furious with myself, with Helene, with Marcus, I shove open the armory door and go straight to the heavy weaponry rack, settling on a tri-flanged mace. I swing it through the air and pretend I'm taking off Marcus's head. When I get back out to the field, the combat centurion pairs me with Helene. My rage spills out of me, tainting every move. Helene, on the other hand, channels her fury into a steely efficiency. She sends my mace flying, and only a few minutes later, I'm forced to yield. Disgusted, She stalks away to battle her next opponent, while I'm still scrambling to my feet. From the other side of the field, I see Marcus watching. Not me, but her. His eyes gleaming, his fingers caressing a dagger. Varys gives me a hand up, and I call Dex and Tristis over, grimacing at the bruises Helene's gifted me. Is Aquila still avoiding you? Dex nods. Like the porks? Keep an eye on her anyway, I say. Even if she wants you to stay away. Marcus knows she's avoiding us. It's only a matter of time before he decides to attack. You do know that she'll kill us if she catches us playing guard dog, Varys says. Which do you prefer, I say. Angry Helene or beaten Helene? Varys goes pale, but he and Dex vow to keep an eye on her, glaring at Marcus as they leave the field. Elias? Tristis lingers, looking alarmingly awkward. If you like, we can discuss... He scratches his tattoo. Well, it's just I've had some ups and downs with Aelia. So with Helene, if you want to talk about it...
Ah, right.
Helene and I aren't... We're just friends. Trista sighs. You know she's in love with you, right? She's not. No. I can't seem to make my mouth work, so I just close it and look at him in mute appeal. Any second he's going to grin and slap me on the back. He's going to say, Just kidding! Ah, Veturius, the look on your face! Any second. Trust me, Tristis says. I have four older sisters, and I'm the only one of the guys who's been in a relationship that's lasted longer than a month. I can see it every time she looks at you. She's in love with you. She has been for a while. But she's Helene, I say stupidly. I mean, come on, we've all thought about Helene. Tristis nods gamely. But she doesn't think of us. She's seen us at our worst. I think of the trial of courage, of my sobs when I realized that she was real and not a hallucination. Why would she... Who knows, Elias? Tristis says. She can kill a man with a twist of her hand. She's a demon with a sword, and she can drink most of us under the table. And because of all that, maybe we've forgotten that she's a girl. I have not forgotten that Helene's a girl. I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about in her head. Girls think about things like this differently than we do. She's in love with you, and whatever happened between you two is because of it. I promise you. It's not true. My head tells me with the zeal of denial. Just lust, not love. Shut it, head, my heart says. I know Helene like I know fighting, like I know killing. I know the smell of her fear and the rawness of blood against her skin. I know that she flares her nostrils very slightly when she lies, and that she puts her hands between her knees when she sleeps. I know the beautiful parts, the ugly parts. Her anger at me is from a deep place, a dark place, a place she doesn't admit she has. The day I looked at her so thoughtlessly, I made her think that maybe I had that place too, that maybe she wasn't alone in that place. She's my best friend, I say to Tristis. I can't go down that road with her.
No, you can't.
There's sympathy in Tristis's eyes. He knows what she means to me.
And that's the problem.
Chapter 31 Liar. My sleep is fitful and scanty, haunted by the Commandant's threat. Time enough for that yet. When I wake before dawn, scraps of nightmare stay with me, my face carved and branded,
my brother hanging from the gallows, fair hair fluttering in the wind. Think of something else. I close my eyes and see Keenan, remembering how he asked me to dance. So shy and unlike himself. That fire in his eyes as he spun me around. I thought it must mean something. But he left so abruptly. Is he all right? Did he escape the raid? Did he hear Veturius shout out the warning? Veturius. I hear his laugh and smell the spice of his body, and I have to force those sensations away and replace them with the truth. He's a mask. He's the enemy. Why did he help me? He risked imprisonment by doing so. Worse than that, if rumors about the Black Guard and their purges are true. I can't believe he did it solely for my benefit. A lark, then? Some sick martial game I don't yet understand? Don't stick around to find out, liar, Darin whispers in my head. Get me out of here. Footsteps shuffle in the kitchen, cook making breakfast. If the old woman is up, Izzy won't be far behind. I dress quickly, hoping to get to her before cook sets us to our daily drudgery. Izzy will know of a secret entrance to the school. But Izzy, it turns out, left early on an errand for cook. She won't be back until noon, cook informs me. Not that it's your concern. The old woman points to a black folio on the table. Commandant says you're to take that folio to Spiro Tullaman first thing, before attending to your other duties. I stifle a groan. I'll just have to wait to talk to Izzy. When I get to Tullaman's shop, I'm surprised to see the door open, the forge fire burning. Sweat streams down the smith's face and into his burned, scarred jerkin as he hammers at a glowing chunk of steel. Beside him stands a tribal girl clad in sheer, rose-colored robes, their hems embroidered with tiny round mirrors. The girl is murmuring something I can't hear over the ringing of the hammer. Tullaman nods a greeting at me, but continues his conversation with the girl. As I watch them speak, I realize she's older than I first thought, perhaps in her mid-twenties. Her silky black hair, shot through with fiery red, is woven into thin, intricate braids, and her dainty face is vaguely familiar. Then I recognize her. She danced with Veturius at the Moon Festival. She shakes Tullaman's hand, offers him a sack of coins, and then makes her way out the forge's back door with an appraising glance in my direction. Her eyes linger on my slave's cuffs, and I look away. Her name's Afia Aranur, Spiro Tullaman says when the woman is gone. She's the only female chieftain among the tribes. One of the most dangerous women you'll ever meet. Also one of the cleverest. Her tribe carries weapons to the Marin branch of the Scholar's Resistance.
Why are you telling me this? What's wrong with him? That's the type of knowledge that will get me killed.
Spiro shrugs.
Your brother made most of the weapons she's taking. I thought you'd want to know where they're going.
No, I don't want to know. Why doesn't he understand? I want nothing to do with whatever it is you're doing. All I want is for things to go back to the way they were. Before you made my brother your apprentice. Before the Empire took him because of it.
You might as well wish away that scar.
Tullaman nods to where my cloak has fallen open, revealing the Commandant's K. Hastily, I pull the garment closed.
Things will never go back to the way they were.
He flips the metal he's shaping with a pair of tongs and continues hammering.
If the Empire freed Darin tomorrow, he'd come here and start making weapons again. His destiny is to rise, to help his people overthrow their oppressors, and mine is to help him do it.
I'm so angry at Tullaman's presumption that I don't think before I speak. So now you're the savior of the scholars, after spending years creating the weapons that have destroyed us.
I live with my sins every day.
He throws down the tongs and turns to me.
I live with the guilt. But there are two kinds of guilt, girl. The kind that drowns you until you're useless, and the kind that fires your soul to purpose The day I made my last weapon for the Empire, I drew a line in my mind. I'd never make a martial blade again. I'd never have scholar blood on my hands again. I won't cross that line. I'll die before I cross it. His hammer is clenched in his hand like a weapon, his hard, angled face lit with tightly controlled fervor. So this is why Darin agreed to be his apprentice. There's something of our mother in this man's ferocity, something of our father in the way he carries himself. His passion is true and contagious. When he speaks, I want to believe. He opens his hand.
You have a message.
I give him the folio. You said you'd die before you crossed that line, and yet you're making a weapon for the Commandant.
No.
Spiro peruses the folio.
I'm pretending to make a weapon for her, so she'll keep sending you with messages. As long as she thinks my interest in you will get her a Tullamon blade, she won't do you any irreparable harm. I might even be able to persuade her to sell you to me. Then I'll break those damn things off.
He nods to my cuffs.
And set you free.
At my surprise, Spiro looks away, as if embarrassed.
It's the least I can do for your brother.
He's going to be executed, I whisper. In a week.
Executed?
Spiro says.
Not possible. He'd still be in Central Prison if he was to be executed. And he was moved from there. Where? I don't yet know.
Tullamon's eyes narrow.
How did you learn he was to be executed? Who have you been talking to?
I don't answer. Darin might have trusted the smith, but I can't bring myself to. Maybe Tullamon really is a revolutionary. Or maybe he's a very convincing spy. I have to go, I say. Cook's expecting me back.
Liar, wait.
I don't hear the rest. I'm already out the door. As I walk back to Blackcliff, I try to push his words from my head. But I can't. Darin's been moved. When? Where? Why didn't Mazin mention it? How is my brother? Is he suffering? What if the marshals have broken his bones? Skies his fingers. What if... No more. Nan once said that there's hope in life. If Darin's alive, nothing else matters. If I can get him out, the rest can be fixed. My path back takes me through Execution Square, where the gibbets are conspicuously empty. No one has been hung for days. Keenan said the marshals are saving the executions for the new emperor. Marcus and his brother will enjoy such a spectacle. What if one of the others wins? Would Aquila smile as innocent men and women twist at the end of a rope? Would Futurius? Ahead of me, the crowd slows to a standstill as a tribal caravan 20 wagons long ambles across the square. I turn to go around it, but everyone else has the same idea, resulting in a mess of swearing, shoving, mired bodies. And then, amid the chaos,
you're all right.
I recognize his voice instantly. He wears a tribal vest, but even with the hood up, his hair trickles out like a tongue of flame.
After the raid, Keenan says, I wasn't sure. I've been watching the square all day, hoping you'd come through.
You got out too.
All of us did, just in time. The marshals took more than 100 scholars last night.
He cocks his head.
Your friend escaped?
If I say Izzy's all right, I'm as good as admitting that I brought her with me to an information drop. Keenan regards me with his unflinching stare. He'll know a lie a mile away. Yes, I say. She escaped.
She knows you're a spy.
She's helped me. I know I shouldn't have let her, but...
But it just happened. Your brother's life is at risk here, liar. I understand.
A fight breaks out behind us, and Keenan rests a hand on my back, turning me so he's between me and the flying punches.
Mazin set a meeting 8 days from now, in the morning. 10th bell. Come here to the square. If you need to meet before, wear a grey scarf over your hair and wait on the south side of the square. Someone will be watching for you.
Keenan,
I think of what Tullamon said about Darin. Are you sure my brother's in Central Prison? That he's to be executed?